Pope Francis is creating a panel to explore whether women can serve as deacons within the Roman Catholic Church. It follows a meeting between Francis and hundreds of women in Rome where the Pope lamented that, quote, the integration of women into the life of the Church has been very weak. For more on this discussion, we're joined this morning by Father James Bretzky, a professor of moral theology at Boston College. The father joins us via Skype. Father Bretzky, good morning, and thanks for speaking to Morning Edition.
Good morning.
So tell us, first of all, it's a commission to study the possibility of women becoming deacons in the church. What question is the commission looking to answer?
Well, I think it's going to be looking to answer two questions primarily. One will be historical, looking back to look at the evidence. What was the role of women in the early church? They certainly had leadership roles. And the question that I think they're going to be most focused on, did that leadership involve what we understand today to be sacramental ordination as deacons? So that's one question. I think the second question, and I think that's more the question Pope Francis is concerned with, moving forward, what could the church do to more directly involve women in leadership roles in the church in a more significant way? One answer to that second question might be we could ordain them as deacons. Another possible answer is we could create a new ministry that they could be instituted in, such as we currently have for lectors. So I think those are the two general questions that are going to be looked at.
Big picture here. This is a very big deal, isn't it?
Yes, it is, because it shows that Pope Francis is open to the idea of reimagining how women could be more present in the church, and he's showing a different approach to this issue than his two immediate predecessors, especially Pope John Paul II, who maintained that women simply could not, the church could never ordain women. And if you can't ordain women to the priesthood, then presumably you couldn't ordain them to the diaconate either, because ordination is one sacrament.
Are you suggesting that there's going to be opposition in the church to this idea?
I'm assuring you there will be opposition to the church in this idea.
How do you think that will play out?
Well, when the idea first popped up in May, when he had that meeting with the superiors of women's orders, Cardinal Mueller, who is currently the head of the Congregation of the Doctrine of Faith, responded, the International Theological Commission has already studied this question, and they've concluded that women's role in the early church is not the same as the sacramental diaconate. And any number of other more conservative bloggers, theologians, etc., have said there is no possibility that women could be ordained, and so they did not welcome the idea of a papal commission.
That was centuries ago. Do you think, though, that this new push, the commission, could eventually lead to women becoming ordained? What are the as priests? What are the chances?
Well, the chances in the next 5 years, I think, are remote indeed. But one reason that there is resistance to the idea of women priests is the same idea that there would be resistance to women in leadership positions in other areas of the world, including President of the United States. You need to have people get accustomed to the idea of seeing women in these unaccustomed leadership roles.
What's the timeline on this? When do they hope to complete the work? When will we know the results of the study that this commission is going to put out?
Well, in an interview this morning that I read with Phyllis Zagano, who is an American laywoman who has been appointed to the commission, she says she doesn't know what the timeline is. She doesn't know when they're going to start, but presumably they will start within the next, the next month or two. And probably, given that the fact that they're literally all over the world, I would imagine the commission will take about a year, perhaps a little bit longer, to complete its study. The last commission that looked at this took a couple of years.
Father James Bretzky, professor of moral theology at Boston College, thanks a lot for speaking to Morning Edition. We'll speak to you again.
My pleasure.
Step up the exercise. Eat really, really well. Stock up on your favorite chewing gum and drink up, because now you're ready for surgery. A new set of guidelines is shaking up decades-old rules for going under the knife, and the results have surgeons across Boston taking notice. WBUR's Martha Biebinger has the story.
Julie Waldman sits in a chair next to her hospital bed at Brigham and Women's Hospital.
I've been up. I did a few laps.
Even though doctors cut into Waldman's colon just yesterday to relieve a severe case of diverticulitis, Waldman says she feels much better than she did after a recent shoulder surgery, a less invasive operation.
I was very nauseous afterwards and was vomiting, and I didn't have any of that this time.
The difference in surgeries is marked.
That's Waldman's husband, Neil.
When she came back from the surgery a few years ago, she was bloated. She was loopy. This time, with a more major surgery, she came right to the room. She was not bloated. She was able to walk really quickly. So I believe in this. I think it was amazing.
This is a set of guidelines developed in Europe about 10 years ago called Enhanced Recovery After Surgery. Waldman's surgeon, Dr. Ron Blade, says it's transforming surgery practices that have been in place for 50 years, beginning with how patients prepare.
The old rule was nothing to eat or drink after midnight. So if you had a 3 o'clock operation, you as a patient were essentially in starvation mode.
And that put the body in distress before the operation began. Now, patients are instructed to drink 2 hours before surgery, preferably a clear liquid with short and long-acting carbohydrates, nothing that puts the patient at risk for vomiting or choking. This brings us to the second major change. Hydrated patients don't need and don't get as much fluid during surgery. They're less swollen, wounds are less likely to get infected, and there is less stress on the heart. The third change, no narcotics, says Blade, or only as a last resort.
In-hospital narcotics slow down the gut. They also cause delirium. And then a person can get hooked on narcotics if they're on them too long. So we emphasize non-narcotic approaches. And that has made a huge difference.
Because if patients are less delirious, they can sit up, if not walk, a few hours after surgery, which speeds recovery. Waldman went home the day after her surgery.
People are going to recover faster, have fewer infections, and fewer readmissions.
Blade says a pilot with colorectal patients at the Brigham proved all of these things are true. Enhanced recovery does not top standard surgery on every quality measure. And some surgeons worry about, quote, running patients dry with about half the traditional amount of fluid. But the practice has spread to other departments at the Brigham and is planned on a pilot basis at all partners' hospitals.
I've been in practice 25 years, and so I go, why didn't we do this earlier?
Blade heard about enhanced recovery after surgery 4 years ago when a Danish surgeon spoke at the Brigham. But persuading some doctors and nurses to change may be difficult.
It's been the way it has been for forever, you know, that I think it's more dogma, to tell you the truth.
Dr. Robin McLeod, a surgeon in Toronto, studied adoption rates of these surgical guidelines at 15 hospitals in Ontario. The adoption rate ranged from 20 to 100%. McLeod says the main problem is communication, making sure everyone agrees to the same plan and explains it the same way to the patient.
So if myself as a surgeon said, Mrs. Brown, you're going to go home in 3 days, and then the nurse says, are you kidding? You're not going to be able to go home for a week. And patients think, oh, well, what should I be doing, you know?
Some elements of enhanced recovery, drinking fluids closer to the time of surgery and moving soon after, have been studied and promoted. The package is spreading quickly across the world, says one of the movement's co-founders, Ole Lundqvist, a professor of surgery in Sweden.
The need for change is becoming very obvious. We need to produce better care at a lower cost, and this is a way of doing that.
At the Brigham, Dr. Blade estimates the hospital has saved more than $2 million in shorter patient stays. Patients following the enhanced recovery protocols do have to supply their own gum. Wait, gum? Neil Waldman, confused about why that was on his wife's hospital packing list, turns to Dr. Blade.
Interesting. Tell us about the gum, because it actually worked. It actually helped her, I think.
The action of chewing gum mimics eating, which then stimulates the gut to wake up.
So chewing is now required 3 times a day, immediately following surgery. Blade encourages patients to go sugar-free, but the effect is the same. Spearmint seems to be the most popular flavor so far. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Martha Biebinger.
We turn now to the Remembrance Project, our series from writer Alyssa Eli about people who've passed. Today, she remembers a teacher who went beyond the call of duty to help his students reach their potential.
Roy Alves was 11 when he emigrated with his mother from the Azores. From the weight of starting life as an illegitimate child in a Catholic community to a less burdened beginning in Rhode Island. His son, Tim Alves, heard the stories.
Yes, it obviously bothered him quite a bit that he never had a father, but that he turned that into a motivating force to do these things for his family. So he took that hurt and turned it into a gain for everyone else, that everyone he was related to.
Neither Roy nor his mother spoke English when they arrived in the United States.
It was just my dad and my grandmother, so they had to make ends meet somehow. So he would go to school during the day and work 8-hour shift afterward.
In the factory, Roy missed so many school days, he might have been held back, except that he charmed his teachers. After college, he became one.
He never remembered a time where he didn't have the desire to teach.
But it was more specific than that. His immersion into a new culture with an unknown language guided Roy's entire career. For almost 30 years, he worked as an ESL teacher and guidance counselor in the Pawtucket School Department.
And a lot of it was about these kids who didn't have a lot of parental guidance growing up, and their parents would be working all the time. And my dad realized that and at times had to be a parental figure to these kids. So when they got in trouble, my dad would just have to set them straight.
When one girl, only 13, became pregnant, Roy pondered the options best for her.
I remember him coming to us and asking, "What would you say if we adopted a baby?" So he was very close to adopting the child of one of his students because he wanted her to achieve things that he was afraid that having a baby at 13 would not allow her to achieve.
He didn't adopt, but he never stopped parenting.
I think that was one of his goals in life, was, you know, he wanted to have kids and to be a father, to actually be a father to someone, to give someone the father that he felt everyone deserves.
For his own two children and the children he taught and counseled, worried over and mattered to, he was.
Writer Alyssa Eli remembering Roy Alves, who died last April in Manchester, New Hampshire. He was 67. The Remembrance Project is a series from the WBUR iLab. If you'd like to suggest a loved one for remembrance, email remember@wbur.org.